And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Until Saturday. I'm Ari Wasserman, joined here by Chris Fanini, who's actually in my house. We just got done watching the first round of the NFL draft. We're going to touch down on a lot of different topics from that draft, both as it pertains to college football and the NFL. Later in the show, we're going to get into Reggie Bush's Heisman saga and how he got his Heisman back. Scott Docterman is going to be joining the show to talk about that segment. Changing college football history. We have some butterfly effect scenarios that we're going to go through. How NIL is impacting the draft as we continue on into the draft this weekend. We're going to check in with Iowa, and we're going to have a pretty big show today. Chris, how are we doing this evening?
Good, man. That was an eventful first round, huh? It was pretty by the books to start, and then things really went off the rails, and we have thoughts.
Yes, I think things started to go off the rails right around the time Atlanta, remember that they were Atlanta, and started acting a little bit crazy. Be sure to follow the podcast on Apple wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please help support the show by dropping a 5-star review. Any way that you can interact with Until Saturday is really good for the show's growth and continued hopes of getting to be bigger and bigger. So, Chris, when we get into the NFL draft, you and I just watched it. There was some screaming in the living room. There was some, I can't believe it's. It was a record-setting evening. 5 quarterbacks were taken in the first 10 picks. That's the first time ever. 6 in the top 12, including Bo Nix at number 12. The first 3 quarterbacks that came off the board were pretty obvious. I think we knew this was going to happen. Caleb Williams came off the board first at number 1 overall to Chicago Bears. Jaden Daniels was selected number 2 by the Commanders. And Drake May, number 3, to the New England Patriots. That's when things started getting a little wonky. You know, the draft continued on as we expected in many ways. Marvin Harrison Jr. at 4. Joe Alt, the offensive tackle from Notre Dame, at 5 to the Chargers. Malik Nabers, the receiver from LSU, number 6 to LSU. Then J.C. Latham, the offensive tackle from Alabama, to the Titans at 7. And then we went to number 8. We were anticipating that it could have been somebody else, a defensive player maybe. But then Michael Penix came off the board and it was just pure shock. What were your initial thoughts of that pick? And, you know, how do you think that that was just kind of an illustration of his talent?
Yeah, man, that was stunning. Not only taking a quarterback, which for all the strange reasons, like the fact that they just signed Kirk Cousins to a $100 million guaranteed contract, and yet they're here taking a quarterback who's about to turn 24 years old. But good for Michael Penix, man. That dude was awesome last year. You covered the Pac-12 championship game. Mm-hmm. I covered Washington, Oregon the first time around, and watching that dude play, throw deep balls, felt like an honor. You and I both had him number 1 on our Heisman ballot. So, like, my first thought was, good for him. Like awesome college player. You weren't sure what NFL teams were going to think of his injury history and all that, but the dude can throw the football.
Yeah, it's probably the prettiest spiral I've ever seen. The Atlanta Falcons took him. I don't know if I mentioned that, but it was so crazy that I even probably forgot to say that. So here's my take on it, and I wrote a column. If you would like to read it, it's on theathletic.com right now. The premise of my column is that the craziness of the Atlanta Falcons' behavior, which is signing an older quarterback or drafting an older quarterback a month after signing a veteran quarterback to a 4-year, $180 million deal, I thought that it was really appropriate where he went when it came to stacking up quarterbacks that played college football last year. I mean, anybody who's listened to the show knows that I have a weird relationship with projecting quarterbacks to the next level. And
NFL teams, by the way. Yeah, they seem to have a hard time doing that.
Like, what I think is going to happen doesn't often happen. But when it comes to the quarterbacks and the order they came off the board, if I were an NFL GM with my rudimentary brain, I would have taken Caleb 1, Drake 2, Jaden 3, Michael Penix 4. Now, the fact that it was in the top 8 shocked some people, and I think that the awkward video of the GM and Arthur Blank, the Falcons owner, talking after the pick kind of made the rounds. So that's how it impacts the Falcons and in the NFL. But when it comes to the college aspect of it, I thought that it was a very reasonable thought to think that Michael Penix Jr. was the fourth best quarterback in college football last year.
Yeah, we'll talk about J.J. McCarthy in a minute here too. But like, Penix had an awesome year. His game against Texas felt a lot like C.J. Stroud's game against Georgia, where it was on the big stage in the same stadium, actually, and you put on a really good performance against a solid defense. And he killed it in the pre-draft prep. Like, at the combine, everybody said he threw the best ball there. Like, he's a guy who did really well in that. The thing holding him back was that, again, he's about to be 24 years old, and he's torn his ACL twice and had a shoulder injury or whatever it was. So, like, those were red flags. But his pure football ability, yeah, he made sense as the number four quarterback to come off the board. So I don't think that was necessarily a surprise. Our colleague Stuart Mandel kept saying over and over, I don't see the J.J. McCarthy fit. I would take Michael Penix first. And yeah, that ended up happening, which I think is, look, we don't know if anybody's going to be good or bad in the NFL. I don't know. But I think it was perfectly reasonable for him to be the fourth quarterback.
Yeah. So I understand that in the NFL, Chris, you have to project out things like injury history and age because it's a huge financial investment. And when you're taking a quarterback in the top 10, that means that you view that player as your franchise player for a decade. So if there are questions about whether or not Michael Penix Jr. is the ideal fit for a team that has a veteran quarterback, I think that those concerns are warranted. And frankly speaking, Kirk Cousins himself, apparently, you know, there's been reports that his camp and he were very confused by this and weren't told that this was happening. And I'm not sure if the Falcons knew when the sun came up on Thursday morning if that was going to be the pick, but it was. And I do think that it is just interesting from a college perspective. Like, he throws the prettiest ball I've ever seen with my own two eyes in person. You saw him in person too, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I saw,
like, does anybody spin it like that you've seen in person? Like, and I know that there's a lot more to being a successful NFL quarterback than how tight your spiral is, but I mean, the guy's got a rocket on him.
I remember Michael Penix, I think it was 2019, played at Michigan State. He completed, I think, 20 straight passes in that game.
Did they score like 9 touchdowns on 9 consecutive drives in that game or something?
No,
like,
I actually think Michigan State won that game, I believe. But
oh, that was the Michigan State win. The year later, they got killed.
Yeah, one of those. Okay. Two. But Penix destroyed Michigan State in his entire career. But I remember watching that game, and I'm like, this guy's got something, this Penix guy. And then he kept getting hurt, and he kept feeling bad for him. And you love that he popped up at Washington and had two unbelievable years. But yeah, he has the most prettiest throw I've ever seen in person. And I'm counting NFL quarterbacks in that. I just, sitting up top at Husky Stadium in Washington, you're way up high. Mm-hmm. You see it from above. It's just, it's like watching a GPS system. It's just, it really is.
I mean, I will say I had that same exact experience because I saw him in an indoor field at the Pac-12 championship game. And that press box is the highest press box I've ever been in.
Yeah.
And when he lets that ball go on a deep ball, it like pierces through the air in a way that I haven't really encountered much in college. Now,
real quick, before we move on, the Kirk Cousins reaction, this is really funny to me, because his agent's been out there telling everybody Kirk is stunned and all this kinds of stuff, and I was like, who cares? Kirk Cousins got $100 million guaranteed. He's going to be okay. And also, let's not forget, Kirk Cousins was drafted in the same draft as Robert Griffin III.
Yeah, well, here's the thing I think that is confusing, and this isn't an NFL podcast, but this is my stab at it. I'm sure he was probably thinking, if you signed me to a $100 million guaranteed contract, it would be really great if we tried to make this year's team better.
Yes.
You know, because he's at the end of his career now, and the Falcons, this pick, if they need to use Michael Penix Jr. this year on the field, then something went incredibly wrong. So, like, from his standpoint, I mean, it's a good segue. I still kind of want to talk about, like, Bo Nix and J.J. McCarthy.
Yeah, let's talk about this, guys.
But we are going to get to the point that this was one of the best receiver classes we've ever seen, too. And Michael Penix Jr. played with Romo Dunze, who was a top six pick. Before we get to the receivers, though, and there were plenty for the Falcons to draft, which is my point. The reason why I brought that up, it's like if you're Kirk Cousins, you probably would have liked to see somebody like that pop up.
I mean, they do have Kyle Pitts, who they've never used in
not once.
So yeah, they do have that.
Sitting on a few rookie cards behind us, Chris. I'm still waiting for those to pay off. But where these quarterbacks went, like, I was very confused in the pre-draft discussion, as you've heard me say 100 times, about J.J. McCarthy flirting with being a top five pick. The man was still a top 10 pick, which is a wonderful place for him to be selected. I think it's a good fit in Minnesota. And I had, coming into tonight, an idea for the column that I wanted to write for the morning, and that was going to be that I had a strong recollection, Chris, of visiting J.J. when he was 17 years old at his high school in Chicago. I sat in the office with him and his high school coach talking about his Michigan commitment. He told me at the time that he wanted to go to Ohio State, that he loved Ohio State, and that was the first time, I believe, that anybody had reported why he became an Ohio State killer. And I remember him saying in that room that he was going to make Ohio State pay. He said, "I used to love them, now I want to kill them." And I remember walking out of that high school, Chris, and thinking to myself, God, that's a sharp kid. He's really given me some great quotes. This is going to be an awesome story. The story did very well. But then I also remember thinking, all right, dude, good luck. You know, you're going against a team that's got 25 more five stars than you. Even if you're a really good player, it's going to be very hard for you to keep that promise. And, you know, having covered Ohio State for as many years as I did, there have been a lot of players in the recruiting process that said that the rivalry was going to change. So I was skeptical. Obviously, I was wrong with that. J.J. McCarthy kept his word. Not only did he kill Ohio State, he won a national championship in college. And I found myself doubting him going into the NFL draft for the same reason. Like, okay, he wasn't that productive in college. He did make very clutch throws at times. He made good plays, but Michigan didn't really lean on him to win games. I didn't really see, much like many people who listen, and Stuart Mandel, who you mentioned earlier, I didn't see the production, the wow factor that we saw from Penix from him in college. And that's even during a national championship run. I mean, there was a close game against Penn State where I think they ran the ball 25 or 26 times in the row. The coaching staff made a concerted effort to take the ball out of a top 10 player's hands in a big game. So all these things kind of, but I wanted to get to the point, and I think I am to the point where A, I don't know who's going to be good in the NFL, and B, maybe it's time to start betting on him. He's already proven multiple people. He's proven Ryan Day wrong. He proved me wrong in that high school that day. He did something that I didn't think was even possible for Michigan. He's a sharp kid. He's a good leader. He has intangibles. Maybe he is going to be a 10-time Pro Bowler in the league, and maybe Minnesota got a steal at 10.
Well, look, in terms of, I mean, proving people wrong, he's a five-star recruit who went 27-1 as a starter, and he's a top 10 pick. This is not exactly Tom Brady's backstory.
Yes, backstory. No, you're right, you're right.
Backstory here.
But his path was difficult, I would say, in my
opinion. A little bit. My take on J.J. McCarthy is I have no idea what to expect from him in the NFL, mm-hmm. simply because we didn't see him tasked to do too much in college. It might work, it might not. Maybe he can carry an offense. We haven't seen it. I just think about the handful of times where they trailed and they needed him to throw their way back into the game. I think about that TCU playoff game when he threw two pick sixes. Mm-hmm. So, like, I've also seen him in person tear a bad Michigan State team to pieces. Like, he's got everything you could want there, but, you know, he wasn't great at throwing the out pass in some of these things. That Alabama game, even the Washington game, remember the whole like second and third quarter, he did like nothing there for a while. So like he's had up and down moments, but he's a winner and maybe he'll keep winning. I truly cannot project him out because I just haven't seen him been asked to win a game for
them. He's very efficient. I don't think that he jumped off the page as a college player. Mm-hmm. And in college, when you're a dynamic NFL player, 9 times out of 10, you can't watch a college game without your face bleeding off looking at that player. Like they stick out in a way that others don't. But again, there have been a lot of really great dynamic players who make great plays who don't do that in the league. So like I'm not out on J.J. McCarthy. I think rationally speaking, he probably went where he should have gone. Like I don't know that I would have taken him in the top five, but getting him at 10, which is still a very high commitment, seems appropriate to me. So
I wouldn't take him in the first round, but I wouldn't take Bo Nix in the first round either.
Well, let's go to Bo Nix.
And so quarterbacks we're at a premium here, and we'll explain why after we talk about Bo Nix.
Yeah, so you made the point. I think a lot of people on Twitter made the point, but it's an interesting point of, A, there was a run of really good quarterbacks this year, Chris, which makes me realize, not that we didn't before, but it reinforced the star power that we're losing from our sport. Because like whenever you have six quarterbacks taken in the top 12, that is six faces of the sport that are leaving. And obviously everybody, you know, replaces these guys and new faces emerge. But it is kind of a sad moment to think that a lot of the guys that we spent the last 2, 3, 4 years talking about are no longer a part of the sport. But then it also was an indication of this early run, 6 and 12 picks, of maybe what the NFL feels about the quarterback position next year. And I wonder if there's going to be a step back in dynamic quarterback play in the upcoming season.
Yeah, and part of that is, too, remember the extra COVID year waiver. I mean, mm-hmm. Michael Penix Jr., Bo Nix, some of these quarterbacks weren't going to be here this past year. They would have been in the previous year. So now that those really good COVID quarterbacks are going to start filtering out, it's very clear that NFL teams are terrified of next year's quarterback class, which is probably like Carson Beck, Quinn Ewers, and maybe Shador Sanders as your top three, and that's not a group I would feel comfortable with. So when Michael Penix goes at number 8, I think everybody panicked, and the Vikings traded up a little bit to get McCarthy. You have the Bo Nix pick at 12, and you have a bunch of offensive players going up until pick 15. So, quarterback is at a premium, and you look at the last couple of years. The hit rate on first-round quarterbacks is not good. Yeah. We have had Zach Wilson.
The 2021 quarterbacks, think about it, Trey Lance, Zach Wilson, Mac Jones, and Justin Fields have all no longer been starters in the league. I mean, maybe Justin Fields will win the job in Pittsburgh, but it didn't seem like that was their plan when they traded for him. So, yes, your point stands.
Yeah, and C.J. Stroud turned out to be, I think, way better than a lot. I know he was the number 2 pick, but I didn't.
I mean, I think you can make the case about that C.J. Stroud's a top 5 player in the league right now.
You could. He's incredible. So, like, we never really know who's going to be good and who's not going to be good at the end. But, yeah, next year, I don't think we're getting 6 quarterbacks in the first round.
It almost felt like the Broncos had to take Bo Nix there because all the quarterbacks, even the ones that were supposed to slip to the second round, were gone by pick 12 or by pick 10. And the Broncos literally don't have a quarterback at all. So, yes, it was a nice little era ending in college football for sure. But also, these quarterbacks played with some very dynamic receivers, Chris. 8 wide receivers were taken in the first round, 6 of whom came from the SEC. And 14 consecutive offensive players started the draft. I can't remember who was the 15th pick. Who was the 15th pick?
Latu.
Oh, yeah. He was the first defensive player. Thank you for the reminder.
Let me do it. Considering we had 8 wide receivers taken, and yet I want to say, I think wide receiver is an overvalued draft.
I disagree.
Because there are so many good receivers. That said, I think Marvin Harrison Jr. is probably the surest thing in this draft.
Yeah.
He's a ridiculous player. He's the son of an NFL Hall of Famer. Like, the bust rate on that is probably not going to be very high. He's unless he gets hurt, I can't imagine him not being a very good player. Malik Nabers, incredible player. Rome Odunze, incredible player. But what did the Chiefs do 2 years ago? They traded away Tyreek Hill. They went and won 2 Super Bowls. And now they
I just don't know that I would use the Kansas City Chiefs as the prime example of that when they've got the greatest quarterback that's ever walked the face of the earth.
I'm just saying you can find wide receivers, and the draft is proof of that.
Yeah.
But the draft is when you get them cheap. I mean, maybe you trade them before they get to that next big contract. Yeah. I think the A.J. Brown trade and that whole deal and the extension, the Lions signing Amon Ross St. Brown to a giant deal, like, it makes sense. He's a young player. I get it. But there's a lot of good receivers.
Yeah, I guess like when you say, like, sometimes you see dynamic receiver, like Stephon Diggs just got trained for a bologna sandwich. Exactly. Like, so like I get maybe there were some other like issues behind the scenes there that we're unaware of that caused that trade. But I do think that like when you think about the players who were taken at the wide receiver position, like a lot of them were attached to the quarterbacks that were taken, you know, like Neighbors and Jaden Daniels. There were two LSU receivers taken in the first round, you know, and so, you know, that said, A.D. Mitchell is still on the board.
Keon
Coleman is still on the board. Johnny Wilson is still on the board. Ladd McConkey still on the board. Like, there's a lot of really good receivers in the second round, and I'm excited for Friday night to see where those guys go. But it just thought it was a very eventful first round. So let me ask you this, Chris. Are there any points that you wanted to make that we didn't get to before we jump into our favorite picks of the day?
No, let's jump into favorite pick.
Okay, you wanted to surprise me. I'll let you go first. What was your favorite pick? And this is just a personal favorite. It doesn't have to be like a fit. We're not NFL experts. We don't have to pretend like we are. But like, which one, like as a NFL fan, which I'm assuming you are, just like watching and fantasy, and I don't want to say betting on it, but like it is a fun thing to watch. So which one are you most excited about? Which one's your favorite?
I think it's Terrion Arnold going to the Lions, getting maybe the best defensive back in this draft. They traded up to do it because of that run on quarterbacks, because of all those offensive guys who went in the first half of the draft, or first half of the round. I tweeted, I was like, I kind of want the Lions to trade up here. There's some really good players I think they should get, Dallas Turner being one of them. They do end up trading up to get Terrion Arnold, who was awesome, and the Lions fans seem to love him. That was a big hole for the Lions last year, was their cornerback spot. And so I think that's a great pick. Nick Saban, who was doing the draft on ABC, was obviously effusive in his praise. So I think that's a great fit. I think that's a great pick for a Lions team that the last couple of years now, they have been nailing these NFL draft picks, like better than anybody in the league. And so I think that's a great, great fit.
My favorite pick is just a sexy, fun, flashy one because that's who I am.
You're sexy, fun, and flashy.
I'm sexy, fun, and flashy, and the camera is on, so just watch out. Xavier Worthy to the Chiefs made me want to pass out, dude. Like, think about it. Like, you just got done talking about Tyreek Hill leaving. I'm not going to compare him to the Cheetah, okay, because Tyreek Hill might be the best receiver in the NFL. He's the fastest man alive. Like, Xavier Worthy, didn't he break the 40 record?
Yes, he did.
And you're adding a player that is explosive. I think he's a very good route runner. Was a very important piece to the Texas team last year. To that offense with that play, with that player at quarterback and with Kelsey. Like, I think that was a very advantageous landing spot for him, and I think it's going to pay off for the Chiefs.
How many times over the last 2 years did we see those clips and those videos of Xavier Worthy getting open downfield and Quinn Ewers unable to get it there, either because of arm strength or because he was late or because it was short or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's not going to be a problem with Patrick Mahomes. We've seen Patrick Mahomes with the fastest receiver in the NFL, and it seems to have worked out pretty well. Now, he does have an issue with drops, as do pretty much everybody on the Chiefs, but you can fix that. They just won a Super Bowl with everybody dropping the ball. Like, you talk about a team that's going for a three-peat, and it's just like it was a layup there to make that pick. Patrick Mahomes and the fastest wide receiver. We know that works. I love that pick.
Okay, and I'm going to give, I don't know if you have a confusing one, because the Falcons was confusing enough for everybody, but I've got one confusing one, and then we can talk about that. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was just the best player available scenario, but Brock Bowers being selected number 13 overall by the Las Vegas Raiders. The Raiders were mocked to grab a quarterback in just about every mock draft that I consumed. Obviously, those quarterbacks were all gone by the time they picked at 13th. And then they went out and got a tight end a year after selecting Michael Mayer.
Yeah.
Obviously, we know what Brock Bowers can do as a college player. Wasn't necessarily a need for the Raiders, but that could be a pretty fun off thing to watch, even if it was kind of confusing.
Yeah, I mean, how many debates did we have last year? Who's the best tight end in college football? Is it Brock Bauer or Michael Mayer? Well, now we're going to know. Now they're on the same team. Who's tight end one? Especially on the depth chart.
Yeah.
So that'll be, I mean, like, look, tight end is a different kind of weapon now, and there were no quarterbacks there. There were, after Bo Nix went, you and I started talking about this. Is Spencer Rattler about to go in the first round?
Like, it was close, yeah. I mean, I thought like
we thought that might happen.
Yeah.
Just because of where things were going. But yeah, I mean, it's a confusing pick, but I don't know. You trade down if someone's willing to trade up, and maybe nobody was willing to trade up. So I don't know. In terms of, I don't know if any other picks outside of Penix and Bo Nix were confusing or surprising. I think everything else pretty much made sense. The Bills traded back twice.
And they needed a receiver, but maybe they realized that A.D. Mitchell and those guys were there still.
That might be it. They trade back with the Chiefs. The Chiefs take Xavier Worthy. They trade back with the Panthers. The Panthers take Xavier Leggett. So, yeah, I mean, maybe they're going to open up the next round with A.D. Mitchell or receiver. Or like I just said, there are so many wide receivers. Maybe they'll be fine for that. I think Ricky Pearsall going in the first round.
That was kind of strange, but he's also really good.
He is. It was surprising, though.
It's just the team that he went to because they have Brandon Ayuk and Deebo Samuel.
Yeah, they're pretty good there at receiver, but, you know, good for him.
All right, Chris, that was a good draft discussion. It was really fun to watch it with you this evening. Why don't we kick it over now and have Scott Docterman join us so we can talk a little bit about Reggie Bush and O.J. Simpson.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF-IN-IOWA. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Okay, Chris, now we're joined by the great Scott Docterman, who has been pumping out really, really good stories this week. If you're not following him on Big Ten College Football Iowa News, then I don't know what you're doing with your life. Scott, how are you doing today, bud?
Ari, I'm great, man. It's draft day. I love this day. I've been watching it since I was a kid. In fact, I was late to school one day back in the 80s because I was late because I was watching the draft at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday. So I can't complain, man.
Tuesday.
That would have been interesting, man, to watch it at 7 a.m. on a Tuesday.
Yeah, well, Ari, when you and I were kids growing up in the 90s, 2000s, it was a Saturday morning, Sunday morning thing. So you're saying earlier it was in the middle of the week, 7 a.m.?
Yeah. It was like 1986, 87 or something like that. They would do it from a ballroom in New York or in New York City at 7 a.m. So it was just like this all day event on ESPN. And then, as you said, later on, I think it was a couple of years after that in the late 80s, early 90s, went Saturday, Sunday and stayed that way until they decided to pop it in for, you know, Thursday night. What was it? 10 years ago or something like that.
But yeah. No, Scott, this is going to be a compliment, I think, but like I view you as more towards my age, so you've got a young soul, and I'm happy that you have a young soul and the wisdom of a man who's been doing this a long time. I think it's interesting transition because we want to talk about something that happened during my childhood and Chris's childhood, which is Reggie Bush being maybe the best player in college football history. I think at least he has a case for that, and part of the reason why I put Pete Carroll on my Mount Rushmore of college coaches. He got his Heisman back on Wednesday. If you have been living under a rock or are under 13 years old, I'll briefly explain like who Reggie Bush was in 2005. He had over 2,200 yards from scrimmage and 18 touchdowns, but like the stats of that whole thing don't necessarily break down who he was. Like the highlight videos, the jaw-dropping moments, just the flash and flare that he played with kind of epitomized the early 2000 USC Trojans. But in 2010, after the NCAA's probe into the punishment of USC, they found impermissible benefits. The trust stripped Bush of the Heisman, and it was the first of its kind decision. And, you know, in the time since that all happened, a lot's changed in the sport. He got his Heisman back. Chris, what was your first reaction to this, and what can you tell me about Reggie Bush that impacted your childhood, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it was about time. This was needed to happen. This wasn't an NCAA decision. The NCAA didn't take away Reggie Bush's Heisman Trophy. The Heisman Trust did, and the Heisman Trust had said they would only reinstate it if the NCAA changed its status. The NCAA didn't do that, and the Heisman Trust still decided to give his trophy back. Basically, if for anybody who doesn't remember, for kids, Reggie Bush basically got money, a home, and some other benefits from Lloyd Lake, an ex-convict who wanted to be Bush's agent when he became a pro. And USC basically got in trouble for possibly knowing about it or should have known about it, didn't check things through compliance. They claim that the assistant coach, Todd McNair, knew about it or should have known about it. Coupled with an OJ Mayo recruitment violation in basketball, they got hit with lack of institutional control, which basically decimated the program, and it has not been the same since. So, you know, Reggie Bush, that 2005 season, to me, like, that Texas-USC game, the greatest game of all time in the history of college football, that felt like the last myth-making moment we've had in college football since then. Things have changed. Cameras are better. Every clip you see of Reggie Bush was even more crazy than you remember at the time. And so, yeah, this needed to happen. It was pretty ridiculous. And I can't help but wonder if this had to do with the timing of O.J. Simpson's death a couple of weeks ago.
I mean, everybody thought that, right?
So the Heisman Trust releases a statement saying we mourn the passing of O.J. Simpson. To which everybody replies, oh yeah, O.J. Simpson has his Heisman Trophy and Reggie Bush does not. This seems kind of ridiculous, right? And so a couple weeks later, he gets his Heisman back. And the trust didn't say anything. The trust simply said, college football has changed. It's a different era. And we decided to do this. But I couldn't help but think about the timing.
What about you, Scott?
When I watched Reggie Bush play back then, He was the most exciting and electrifying athlete and running back that I've ever seen. And since then, I think guys like Lamar Jackson and, you know, Vince Young, even to an extent, have kind of maybe overshadowed a little bit of what he did on the field. But as a running back, as a pure player, the one before that, probably Barry Sanders was probably the most exciting player that I can remember before that era right there. And I think when you look at this situation, you know, the O.J. Simpson one, I think probably did instigate some of this, because when people are comparing a alleged murderer who was found innocent by a court of law and he still has his Heisman Trophy, and somebody who was basically convicted of doing everything that now is legal in college sports and he doesn't, I think it did probably, you know, allow the trust to think differently about this. And it's right. And, you know, this era, when you look back at some of the other small little details from back then, the gold pants saga at Ohio State, or Kelvin Sampson's situation at Indiana, that are now just really, they got in trouble for that. That I think when you look at this situation now, it with 2024 eyes, it makes no sense to not have him not have his Heisman Trophy.
So I think that the number one thing that I hear from people, and I'm sure you guys do too, is it doesn't matter if the rules have changed since or if we view things differently. they knowingly broke the rules while the rules were in place, and you have to be penalized for breaking rules. Rules change, then behaviors change. But if you broke the rules then, you still broke the rules. And I think I understand that a little bit. But in a world where O.J. Simpson still had his Heisman, and Johnny Manziel, by the way, who was a champion for Reggie Bush getting his Heisman back, he said he was no longer going to attend the Heisman ceremony and wasn't going to participate in events and things like that in regards to the Heisman until Reggie got his Heisman back, just had a documentary glorifying his autograph scheme. So, like, yeah. It's just like and it's kind of the same thing to me as like the Baseball Hall of Fame. It's like, you're not going to put certain people in the Baseball Hall of Fame who use steroids. And I think that makes sense because steroids was cheating, but it's either kind of like an all or nothing type of thing. It's like, you can't just victimize or personally attack or take away accomplishments of one or two people when there's a bunch of people who are behind that wall that have engaged in similar activity. And we might not have known, you know, what some of the winners from the 90s and earlier 2000s or even later 2000s did during their time in college. But it just kind of seemed weird of like all the people who didn't have their Heisman that like Reggie Bush did because he got a sick place to live while he was in school.
Yeah. And remember, this wasn't USC paying him money or even a USC booster paying him money. It was somebody outside of that and USC not doing a good enough job supposedly of controlling all of that. And so, you know, things have changed so much. I wrote a story like 2 years ago about the SMU death penalty. And I talked to Dan Beebe, former commissioner of the Big 12, who was was with the NCAA at the time, one of the investigators. And he made the same point of like, look, it was against the rules at the time, and everybody knew that. So no, I don't look back and think, oh, we shouldn't have done that, because that's what it was. Everybody knew you couldn't take money and do all these different things, even if it was stupid, and we've come around to that. And so that's how it is. But there have been a few instances that have changed how we view this type of stuff in the years since. Todd Gurley getting suspended for like a couple $1,000 in autographs. The Johnny Manziel one. To the point where, along with rising coach contracts and all these beautiful facilities, and eventually everybody realized, all right, this isn't right. And that's why we have these lawsuits. That's why we have NIL. That's why we have a lot of things. And a lot of it comes back to both Reggie Bush, some of the other players, the video game, and essentially what is sort of the death of amateurism, which we're kind of on the road to completing.
Yeah, it's kind of just like the acceptance that the world is different, right? Like, it's the thing that is so interesting to me and has always been during this whole transitional period into the compensation era is that not only was taking money or benefits against the rules, it was also viewed upon by people who weren't a part of the sport as criminal behavior. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like the pursuit of financial gain, you know, was kind of felt like you're a bad person or you're not about the right things and all that stuff. And it's just like crazy now that the toothpaste is out of the tube to go back and look at a time in which people were viewed that way of like, you're a cheater, you're a scumbag, you're, you know, all the things that people used to say and kind of still conditionally do because we've been taught through our entire childhoods to view it that way. And it's like, I think this was a nice step in the right direction of normalizing the new era. And hopefully we can stop decriminalizing or criminalizing people for engaging in financial decisions that impact them and their families.
And Reggie Bush, every player has an agent nowadays. You know, the idea of somebody giving a player things because they want to be their agent, you couldn't do that at the time. That still would be against the rules, the agent specifically giving them money, giving them a house or whatever. But what would have been different nowadays is it would have been a company would have given Reggie Bush a house. A company would have given Reggie Bush money as sponsorship deals. So technically what Reggie Bush did was still against the rules. It just wouldn't have played out that way if those rules didn't exist. That's why it's a little bit different.
You know, I look at this is similar to the Fab Five with Michigan and, you know, the uncle, you know, from Detroit basically giving, you know, Chris Webber some money. And And then you go down the street, of course, anytime in that era, 30 years ago, they were larger than life. And I look at that as sort of in the same vein. Now, I think there is a difference between the NCAA and the Heisman Trust. And I think there's a difference mm-hmm. between what you can do and what you can't do. And I think now people will start to wonder about, you know, should USC get its championships back? You know, should that's problematic because you are talking about institutional situations that impacted the sport as a whole. But when you're talking about individuals and what individuals can and can't do, absolutely giving him back that trophy, because watching him play was remarkable. And he was the best player on the field every time he stepped on it. No offense to
that Matt is Liner, the Heisman.
Reggie Bush's. Yes. So he should absolutely get that back.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Chris, where do you stand on USC's program as a whole and whether or not it should receive its vacated wins and national championship back?
No, it's interesting because the NCAA to this point is trying not to do postseason bans. They understand that vacating wins doesn't really mean anything. They're encouraging people to cooperate with investigations now. But the NCAA giving USC's wins back is a completely different decision from Reggie Bush's Heisman Trophy. The Heisman Trust took away the Heisman Trophy. The NCAA had nothing to do with that. They just had their own ruling, and the Heisman Trust made a decision off of that. The NCAA didn't give Reggie Bush's Heisman back because they didn't take it from him. So the idea that now the NCAA should give back USC wins and championships and all this kind of stuff, that's not going to happen. I wouldn't expect it to happen. It also doesn't matter. I mean,
but don't even take
knows
it from the Reggie Bush standpoint.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Everybody
take it from
knows
like just like the NCAA yeah. rules have changed standpoint and like how stupid it is. Like, do you think that the right. trust's decision creates momentum for other entities to follow suit and doing the same things, even if they're not related?
I do not, because if the NCAA does this, then it's going to have to retroactively pull back all sorts of penalties for all kinds of teams and individuals and this and that. And that's not a that's
do
not
it.
A
Who
door
cares?
They want to open. Everybody knows USC won the 2004 national championship. We saw that game. The idea of taking things down was always pretty ridiculous. I think Michigan put up the Fab Five banners again, right?
They did, now, that right, wasn't, Scott?
I think that's case, yeah.
That wasn't the NCAA necessarily taking things away. Michigan penalized itself in a lot of those types of things. But, yeah, I mean, you want to open up the books and throw everything out. I wouldn't do that because, like we said, it was against the rules at the time. Everybody knew it was against the rules at the time. The rules were stupid, but you can't retroactively change history, even though that's exactly what they tried to do by vacating the penalties, I guess, vacating
you know,
the championships.
When OJ died, I realized that I had never watched the FX show, American True Crime Story. I don't know if you've guys
oh,
ever watched
it. Oh, man. It's incredible.
I watched awesome. The second season about Gianni Versace, and I watched the Monica Lewinsky season, and I thought to myself, I've never watched the OJ one, and I remember how good 2 and 3 were. I was like, I'm gonna watch it. So I watched it like last week after he died. And I think they said the word Heisman in the television show at least 5 or 6 times. I think that one of the lawyers in the defense or the prosecution of O.J. Simpson mentioned it in his final statement to the jury. And in the final scene of the show, they showed the Heisman, I believe. And I will admit that I thought about Reggie Bush while watching the show. Like, I feel like, I don't know, we can't prove that this is OJ related, but it had to have been, right? Like, it just had to have been.
First off, that American Crime Story, very entertaining show. John Travolta, Cuba Gooding Jr., David Schwimmer saying juice a million times. It's a very, I got a kick out of it watching it when it was live. Like, it was fun. The OJ Made in America ESPN documentary is much more historically accurate. Okay. I would say there are some dramatizations. Yeah. They go out of their way to mention the Kardashian daughters in that American Crime Story.
5 times, yeah. Well,
yeah. But right. But they're not, I'm sure they'll never admit it, but I do think the timing of OJ Simpson may have had to have spurred this on. It was just a couple of weeks ago. By the way, USC football, I don't think even really said anything about OJ Simpson passing. It was the Heisman Trust that did.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, USC knew what they were doing. I don't think the Heisman Trust expected the reaction it got, I guess. And yeah, everybody said, wait a minute, the Heisman Trophy is honoring OJ Simpson and they're not honoring Reggie Bush. There's an uproar. A couple weeks later, you know, they changed their mind without the NCAA doing anything different. They had said even like a year or so ago, but remember Reggie Bush like filed a lawsuit to get it back essentially. And the NCAA, the trust said, if the NCAA changes his status, we'll give him the trophy back. They didn't do that. The NCAA did not change its status and the trust still gave it back. That has to be related to the timing of OJ Simpson.
In future mailbag episodes, I'm going to ask how OJ's defense was able to alter the interior of his house for the jury to see it, because I don't understand how that could happen.
Have you seen the OJ Made in America one by ESPN?
Yeah, I think so. I need to go back and watch it. It's been years, but I do not understand if the point of inviting the jury into the home was for them to get a better sense of the crime scene, how they were able to change the art and the vibe of the home in order to subconsciously change the way the jury viewed him. I don't know how that is not illegal. So a lawyer, just send me an email and let me know. I know this turned into an OJ show, but I don't understand how that's allowed.
Imagine if we had podcasts back in the early 90s to break down this trial, or all the people on TikTok doing it. It would have been crazy.
Well, could you imagine if we were covering college football during it?
I tell you what, it was the craziest thing I can ever remember. And this was before the internet. It was before social media. And this was just word of mouth and TV. But June 17th, 1994 was a day that lives in infamy because of that Bronco chase. And then all the other side events that went on that day, you know, the World Cup, the NBA Finals, right around the NHL playoffs. But I can't remember anything more crazy. And then the scene afterwards, and then the trial of the century. It was the talk about story. I was in college. It was the talk about story in the country. And just imagine what it would be like on Twitter, TikTok. It would be.
Scott, what were you doing? What were you doing then? Do you remember watching it? The chase?
Yeah, I was actually at my aunt's house. For some reason, I think they were just moved in or something and I was helping them. But yeah, I was just sitting there and I'm like, I can't believe this, because we were young and in college and being smart asses. But like me and some people I worked with at the mall at the time, we're like, yeah, if OJ's loose, you know, we'll hide him out and all that stuff, you know, just being stupid. And then all of a sudden that chase came down and we thought he was going to kill himself. I mean, I really did at that point. And then, lo and behold, we had one of the most incredible moments, really. The jury situation, or when the verdict was read, was pretty wild, too.
Okay, so probably enough O.J. Simpson discussion for today, but I do think that
Reggie Bush, yeah. It's good he got his Heisman back.
Conclusion. Thank you.
Yeah.
You got to reel me in sometimes, dude. Like, you know, I go off the... So there, Scott had an interesting prompt as we were preparing for this podcast about going back and changing history. Why don't you explain that prompt, Scott, and we'll see if we can throw a few interesting answers out there.
Yeah, I think when you're looking at history of college football, there's all kinds of efforts to want to erase or change something that did or didn't happen. And I think in college football, I wanted to go back and change one thing, and that's ties. What would have happened if there were no ties in college football? And there's some games that, you know, really a couple that stand out above the rest for me. One is 1966, the Notre Dame-Michigan State tie, where Notre Dame was basically taking quarterback sneaks to ensure that it was 10-10 and then eventually won the national title because it tied Michigan State, which was number two. And then Alabama was undefeated and untied and ended up number three. I would have liked to have seen an overtime period in East Lansing that day and see what might have happened. And then 7 years after that was probably the most combative tie in college football history. Michigan and Ohio State, 10-10. And that they were undefeated, untied. The winner went to the Rose Bowl. The loser didn't get to go to a bowl game because the Big Ten only had one team go to the bowls. And it ended up going to the athletic directors. So everybody was on different sides, and it was 6-4 vote that sent Ohio State to the Rose Bowl, Michigan home. And then Bo Schembechler decided, and rightly so, to change the rules to where everybody can go to bowl games if you're invited. But then there were a couple of other games that kind of stand out to me. I won't monopolize this segment, but one is the 1984 situation. We got a great Orange Bowl between Nebraska and Miami, where Nebraska decided to go for two. Well, if there was overtime in that period, they would have just kicked an extra point, and they might have been the national champion because I think they were the best team in the country that year. And then finally, a little more funny, but it really hurt Notre Dame in a tie, was in 1953 when Frank Leahy was the coach, and he was facing Iowa in South Bend, and with 32 seconds left in the game, a couple players fall down. They get issued a timeout. 6 seconds left. They're inside the 10-yard line. Another guy gets an owie. They get another timeout, and then they score on the game's final play to tie the game 14-14, and they were ranked number one in the country. And John Lattner said after the game, oh, that's pretty smart thinking. There shouldn't have been a tie in that situation. And then Forrest Evashevsky was never known for his political correctness. I won't use exact words he said, but when the one great scorer comes to write against our name, he won't write whether we won or lost, but how we got blanked at Notre Dame. And ultimately Notre Dame fell in the polls because of that, did not win the national title because of that. I think Iowa should have gotten another crack at the Irish that day.
So we had players faking injuries 70 years ago before we even had up-tempo offenses, huh?
Yeah, before Jarrell Worthy did it in Iowa City.
we didn't need to get back to that one.
Chris, weren't you?
I don't think I was at that game, but I did cover it. I actually wrote a story in 2020 about the last tie in college football history. A lot of people think it's Wisconsin-Illinois in 1995, mm-hmm. a 3-3 game, but it wasn't. The next month, December 1995, there was a tie between Central Washington and Findlay, and it was the NAIA Division II National Championship game. The National Championship ended in a tie. The quarterback of that Central Washington team, John Kitna, of all people. So that was a fun story I did. It was a fun story I did a number of years ago, the very last tie in college football history. It was a championship game, which is crazy to think about. Ari, did you have any thoughts on ties?
I think ties are anti-American.
I agree. One thing I would change for college football history, it's more NFL, but it ties into college football, that the Miami Dolphins doctors clear Drew Brees on his physical. He signs with the Dolphins instead of Dante Culpepper. Mm-hmm. And as a result, Nick Saban stays with the Dolphins and doesn't come back to college football a year or so later at Alabama, creating a Death Star of a program in Alabama, which completely changed the history of college football. Nick Saban is amazing. I just think about how Alabama's dominance over the last 15 years really reshaped everything we know about college football, from the postseason, from recruiting, from coaching, and everything. And so, like, my golden era of college football is like that mid-2000s, like 03 to like 07-ish, that period. That was my formative years for college football. And everything after that is just the Alabama era. So I would have loved to have not had the Alabama era happen. And maybe we would have gotten more seasons like 2007.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like what the biggest butterfly effect thing would be for me. And I went down a Reddit rabbit hole, and there were some crazy ones on there. Like, I was just reading it, and there is one that basically suggests that if Pearl Harbor never happened, Arkansas would be Alabama right now. So we can go down that rabbit hole. But Scott, why don't we pivot again to a story that you wrote? If you're listening to this, it is after the first round of the NFL draft. There's still more draft coverage to go, and I think that the later rounds are probably more impacted by this. But the NIL situation in college football is encouraging more players that otherwise would have gone to the NFL draft in the past to return because they're being compensated while also continuing their development. Scott wrote a really interesting story. There are 58 underclassmen in this year's draft. That's the lowest figure since 2010 and down 130 from 3 years ago, which was the beginning of the NIL era. What did you find in your story, Scott?
It's really fascinating when you talk to players and to GMs at the next level, is that, how NIL has impacted the draft. And I think when you start to talk to players with the COVID years that have that opportunity, you have the chance to go to the NFL and be a mid-late drafted player, maybe even a priority free agent, or have the security that college football provides you with more money. One thing I looked at was in the seventh round, the average signing bonus is 90,000 ish. And that is, when you compare that to somebody who, even a position player at a major Power Five institution, Power Four, whatever you want to call it these days, they're making more money than that. If they're a team captain, if they're a first round or first team all conference center or something like that, they're probably making double, $200,000. So there's the security of sticking around. Likewise, and this is probably to me a bigger deal and more important in the big picture, is the underclassmen numbers. Because going from 130 to 58 in that short period of time means that a lot of players that before were just making the jump because of money are now getting better developed. They have an opportunity to compete at for multiple schools if they want to. And then they have the opportunity to maybe even get a degree accidentally. So when you're talking about that versus going after your junior year and getting to be a sixth round pick and maybe getting cut or not even get drafted, and then your career is over with, you're staying, you're getting more money. You got an opportunity to probably be better coached. It's not as cutthroat at the collegiate level as it is at the NFL. And then to top it off,
you get
off,
more reps that you don't get in the NFL because you're not playing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've all covered college football players who left after their junior year, and we knew that they weren't going to be drafted high and potentially not at all, but they left because they had to get some money for their family or something like that. Like, we've all covered guys like that. And that's why, as much like people want to say, oh, I don't like this NIL, it's ruining college football. No, it's helping college football because it's keeping these really good college players who are maybe not NFL players in college. That's a good thing. We've seen it in basketball. We've seen it in football. And you have just a better talent pool of players year to year now. I think that's a very positive thing. On top of course.
Do you think we'll ever get to a point in NIL where first round picks stay in school? Or is it just too much money?
Well, you tell me. There was those rumors about Marvin Harrison
I think that was crap, though. I don't know if that was real. But I do wonder if there's ever a time where we'll get enough money involved in this NIL space. Because it is interesting. It is impacting the players who might be fifth, sixth, seventh round picks. I don't think it's really affecting the top end of the draft. Like, when Dane Brugler came on to the show, he said that this is an issue and players are getting selected in the draft now that otherwise would have been undrafted free agents in the past because of the sheer number droppage. But like, are we ever going to get like a, maybe not a first round or a top five pick, because that's a little dramatic. But like, what about a middle second round player who, by the way, if you're a middle second round player, you are a really, really, really good college player. I wonder if they were ever going to get to a point where it's like somebody who is a bona fide top two round pick decides to come back because the NIL package that they get is more attractive than being in the NFL.
From what I know, that there will be a, there are a couple of players that'll be that way, but NIL will probably be the secondary reason. It'll be, I could be, you know, like, let's say you're the fifth best offensive lineman, like an Alu Fashanu from Penn State. Last year, he's probably a late first round guy. But now when you combine, he can get NIL from Penn State and get another year of improvement to put himself to be a top 10 pick, then that's where you'll see that that fit a little bit more. It won't be, I don't know that you'll see many running backs, for instance, do that. If they're, you know, like a Jonathan Brooks, for instance, from Texas, you know, with his ACL, does it make sense for him to go back to college? Probably not. But somebody who can parlay one more year of school and go from being a late first round or early second round or pass rusher or offensive lineman, and instead one more year, bam, you're a top 10 pick. That, yeah, NIL will definitely help with that, because it's like you can get a maybe a seven figure deal and still stay in your school and get better, and next year make that up at the NFL level.
Yeah, and we've had first round players stay in school forever. I mean, it's been even before NIL, going back to Reggie Bush. I mean, Matt Leiner did that. He came back to school after the 2004 national championship that doesn't count technically. So we've had it happen before. You throw in NIL on top of that. Yeah. Now, is there ever going to be an NIL deal that's better financially for a player to stay in school than to go pro? I don't think so. I don't think we're going to ever have, when you account for the years you're signing for, multiple going forward, the ability to get into the NFL sooner to get to your next contract. No, I don't think an NIL deal will ever be a better financial decision for a player to come back, but it certainly has and will continue to, I think, help some first round talents stay in school.
It's interesting though, with the COVID kids who are still in college, there's more players right now that are probably older and more NFL ready. And the numbers are still down. Scott, how do you think that the COVID eligibility running out the next year or so is going to impact this?
Well, I think next year you're going to see a floodgate of players that were probably anywhere from fifth, sixth, seventh rounders who are now enter the draft. And then you're going to push draft guys out of the draft next year. I mean, you know, the two schools that kind of come to mind where guys really stayed and decided to use that extra year and will have impacted it, Ohio State and Iowa. You look at Iowa, they have, I think it's eight sixth-year guys that returned, and then a couple other guys who were, you know, they're going into year five, and they had a redshirt year, and they ended up staying. There were, you know, the NIL did impact that for sure, and I'm sure at Ohio State where, you know, Jack Sawyer and JT, you know, the pass rusher and all those other guys. I mean, they've got an opportunity to again, boost their draft stock by returning. So I think it's going to be interesting in 2025 what happens with the draft when you have all these COVID guys. And then conversely, and I'm going to look into this too, is the 21 guys got screwed multiple different ways because the market was flooded when they came into college. And a lot of them either lost scholarships or lost scholarships to higher levels. And then they don't get the extra year that's being taken up right now by the COVID guys. And so they're getting squeezed in multiple ways. And that's really kind of unfortunate.
Well, one last thing I'll say on this point is it's pretty crazy that Brock Purdy, who took his team to the Super Bowl this last year, is making less money than a lot of college quarterbacks. Brock Purdy's salary was about $900,000. Now, there might be some bonuses and stuff in there, but less than $1 million for a Super Bowl game quarterback. There are a lot of college quarterbacks making $1 million or more, which just goes to show, especially at that position. Kalen Keller, our colleague, wrote a story about this last year about the quarterbacks who are staying in college because of that, because you can make more. You could be a mid-round pick and be making more and stay in school, make more money than the guy who went to the Super Bowl, which is just kind of wild.
Yeah, and obviously that will correct its course. Guys, I want to say I regret something. Because earlier on in the show, and we're going to check in with Scott on some Iowa stuff because they've been in the news a little bit. I feel bad that like I alluded to the Pearl Harbor thing with Arkansas and then didn't finish the thought. So if you're somebody who wanted to hear the end of it, I apologize. Just let me tell you real quick. I'm going to read this.
Yeah,
in I'm December of 1941, Arkansas native Bear Bryant was driving to Fayetteville to interview for and certainly be offered the open head coaching position for the Arkansas Razorbacks. On the way, he heard the radio broadcast that broke the news. America had been attacked. Coach Bryant promptly turned his car around, drove home, and enlisted in the Army. Obviously, we can't know for sure that he would turn Arkansas into the powerhouse that he later did with Alabama. It seems more likely that he would have stuck around with the Hogs instead of leaving like he did at Kentucky and Texas A&M, since that would have been in his home state. That, to me, I think is like, we could do like a college football would like crazy show, but this is just written by a Reddit user a year ago named Prince Walker 22. It's just on the Reddit college football page, biggest butterfly effects in college football. I thought that was something interesting to share. If you have any ideas or thoughts on the butterfly effect thing, we'd love to hear it. Like, comment, and subscribe, obviously, with the podcast, but call in and leave a voicemail, 316-462-9852. Again, that is 316-462-9852. Call in, leave us your story. If it's really good, we'll play it.
Real quick, to follow up on that, a little history lesson for college football. The COVID Rose Bowl that got moved to Dallas a couple years ago.
Yeah,
that
was the Walmart Sunset.
The second Rose Bowl to not be played at the Rose Bowl. The other one was because of Pearl Harbor. It was the 1942 game, right. Duke and Oregon State. They played that game January 1st, 1942 in Durham, North Carolina.
You are just an encyclopedia of knowledge, Chris. I'm happy you're on the show. All right, Scott, let's talk a little bit Iowa because we have to. Iowa's open practice was last Saturday, and you were there. Tim Lester's offense had pre-snap motions, which I guess is a pretty big deal. How did the scheme look? How did the team look? And are they going to be better offensively this year?
It was really hard to gauge in some ways because they didn't have their quarterback out there that they're going to have in June. Cade McNamara is still recovering from an ACL. There is much more pre-snap motion, which is something that when they've dabbled with it, it's worked. And it's just a matter of banging my head against the wall saying, do it more. I've asked a million times and written about it that you need to do this more because the numbers jump up on average yards per carry by 2 per carry when you have pre-snap motion versus when you don't. So they have it now, and it's a staple of this. And Tim Lester's RPO game is something that seems to be an improvement, which of course, you know, me and you could devise a plan and it'd be an improvement based on what they look like the last few years. But I, you know, and it's hard to gauge in a scrimmage situation against a really good defense, but I did see some room for improvement in the running game in particular. Now, you know, a quarterback, Deacon Hill, who took the snaps last year, has entered the portal. And so we'll see, you know, right now, Cade McNamara is the guy. They are looking in the portal, absolutely, at quarterback, not just to concede to do Cade McNamara, but to compete with Cade McNamara, provided a quarterback that they want is going in there. But overall, I think they're in a pretty good shape if they can get their offense to continue to take steps forward.
Yeah, the Deacon Hill thing was interesting. Go ahead, Chris.
How many years in a row have you ended with that sentence? If they can just get some things going on offense.
Yeah, this year I actually kind of mean it. I don't know about the last two or three years. I had some questions, some serious questions, but part of it is that they do have a veteran offensive line and their running game is good. And they have, in my opinion, the best tight end in the country in Luke Lachey. So I think that really goes for them. They were able to run the ball on their own defense, which most teams were unable to do that. And they were able to do that somewhat. So I think that was a positive. It's really going to come down to the passing game, and they've entertained some guests the last few days from the portal, and again, you know, quarterback is going to be a major factor for them. But defensively, they're going to be as good or better than any team in the country there. So if, you know, it's like we've said last couple of years, if their offense can just get to the, you know, top of the bottom third in college football, that this team will be, you know, a very competitive team. And I think schedule wise, they've got a chance to contend for the playoff. I do think that.
And do you believe that McNamara is going to be healthy to start if he does indeed win the job, like to open the season?
I think, yeah, I think he's going to be healthy enough. They anticipate in June that he'll be full go for all workouts and in August. I think the fear is, and this is part of the reason why they're heavily scoping the portal right now, is, you know, he's been injured the last 2 years. He's played in 8 total games. Last year was an ACL. The year before he had, I think it was meniscus tear. And so there is a fear that what happens if he's gone, you know, they're going to be in real trouble there like they were last year. So, you know, once the portal kind of provides the quarterback, they do have the money and resources to go get it. And that person will be at worst number two, if not competing with Cade McNamara to start.
Do you think that Cooper DeJean would beat Caitlin Clark in one-on-one basketball?
Yeah, I do. I think, but not in horse. So he's a freak athlete, man. I mean, he had more points than Harrison Barnes did in high school, and he's been dunking since 8th grade. He's really freakish there. He could have helped the men's basketball team at Iowa. So yeah, he could drive past her all day and night. But if you want to start throwing up, you know, play a game of horse, he's losing by several shots.
Apparently, NFL teams were asking him that question during the pre-draft process, and I thought that was amusing.
Well, so if you're an NFL scout, what do you want that answer?
What's the answer supposed to be?
I'd win. You know, you're talking about the most popular athlete in the country. You'd have to bet on yourself. And in his case, it was funny because I asked Tory Taylor that at the combine, because that's when Cooper revealed it to me that he'd been getting those questions. And he's like, oh, Cooper totally win that one. So I think your answer is, I'd win, but I think you'd also throw some respect to Caitlin Clark, who can do more things shooting a basketball than just about any man or woman or child in this world.
If you're going to interview me for a job at any time in the future, just let you know right now, I could not beat her in one-on-one. I just want to be frank about that.
Well, I'm not hiring you then.
Anybody listening, if you are scoping me out for a job, I could not beat Caitlin Clark. All right, both of you wrote really important stories. First, what about your Florida filing a suit against Florida State filing a suit against the ACC story? Why don't you take us through that?
Yeah, let me get, here's your legal beat update here, which every time I'm on the show, I feel like I got to do one of these.
You got to get some law and order music or something there.
This is what college sports is these days. On Thursday, the Florida Attorney General filed a lawsuit against the ACC over the ESPN TV contract and making that a public record. The Attorney General in January had requested the contract. The ACC said, no, it's trade secrets. We're allowed to keep this in the office here in the headquarters and not give it to a third party. I don't think this will have any impact on Florida State's attempt to get out of the ACC, which is a different issue. The most interesting thing about this case is that if it's successful, not only are we going to see the ACC TV contract, we're going to see the SEC contract, the Big 12 contract, the Americans contract, and all these conferences that have public schools in Florida. Almost all of them, except for like the Big Ten, the Mountain West, and the Sun Belt, I think. But that could also be a precedent to allow it in other states based on their public records laws. So I don't know if this is going to work. I don't think it really matters in the grand scheme of things. It's just interesting to us who may want to see what those TV contracts are, because they're real secretive. They won't let it out. They won't tell anybody all these business things that go on that we don't know. So we'll be following it. That's a case that could impact everybody, not just Florida State. So it was kind of interesting to me. I figured I would drop that in here.
Scott, you also wrote a story about the gambling probe in Iowa. Why don't you take us through that a little bit?
Yeah, we're coming up on 1 year when this became public in Iowa, where the Division of Criminal Investigation in Iowa put a warrantless geofence around the athletic facilities at Iowa and Iowa State. They conveniently forgot UNI and Drake, but they put a geofence around those two, accumulated all kinds of information on from gambling on, and most of them were players. And it obviously became a major story throughout all of the summer and early fall in Iowa, where ultimately more than, let's see, it was 41 athletes were impacted, several other dozen students, and ultimately there were a ton of suspensions. So I went through that saga and then what has really transpired since January, which is under oath, they admitted they didn't have a warrant for this. And in fact, one of the key agents dropped out because he felt like it was illegal. And now this week, we'll see a federal lawsuit violating civil rights filed on behalf of all the athletes involved. And I used an Iowa player as an example. He told me less than $100. I've been told basically it was $50. He bet on the women's basketball team last year at the Final Four, and he was suspended for the entire season, and it was upheld multiple times by the NCAA. And he was a 2-year starter at defensive tackle, came back for his sixth year, and ended up losing his last year based on a small bet on the women's basketball team. So it also kind of leads into the NCAA's rules and what they've changed, what they will change. So it's a fascinating development, and it's a cautionary tale, certainly, that for gambling. And then also it shows the NCAA kind of needs to upgrade it with the times, considering it's legal to gamble and have sources providing revenue to athletic departments that are gambling establishments.
All right, guys. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Like, comment, subscribe. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Wherever you listen to podcasts, call 316-462-9852. That's the Until Saturday phone line. Leave a voicemail, question, comment, concern, butterfly effect, anything. We'd love to hear it. Again, that is 316-462-9852. Enjoy the rest of the NFL draft over the weekend. I'm sure more stuff's going to pop off in the transfer portal, and we'll have plenty to talk about when we return on Tuesday. Thanks again for listening, and that was the latest edition of Until Saturday.